Moving on to our main topic, the 14th of June marks World Blood Day. So this week, we're putting the process of blood donation under the microscope. In the UK, with a population of about 65 million, the NHS Blood and Transport Service collects around 2 million blood donations every year, which is a good job considering that our hospitals need about 8,000 units, a unit being roughly one pint, every single day, just to meet demand.
But before blood transfusion got going and the important role of the blood system was actually appreciated, doctors were much more fond of taking the stuff out of people, and they had some pretty ingenious implements for doing just that. Heather Douglas went to the Wellcome Collection in London, where they have some of them, to meet science and medicine historian Richard Barnett.
We're here in front of three objects which point towards one of the most widely used medical therapies in history, which is bleeding. This is a medicine which is based on the idea of balance and the balance of four humours.
The idea of humours dates right back to the ancient Greeks. The theory goes that the body had these four disgusting-sounding liquids, black bile, yellow bile, phlegm, and of course blood, and that to keep healthy, they had to be in balance.
Now, within this system, blood has a particular function. Blood is the nutritive humour. The idea is that blood is made in the liver and then sent out around the body, and it carries food, essentially. And disease in this model is imbalance. You can have too much of a humour or too little of a humour. Now, if you have too much of a humour, the doctor's job is to get rid of it, and this is where bloodletting comes in.
Bloodletting wasn't the only way to balance the body, but it was an easy and popular treatment because everybody bleeds. It was so popular that implements called scarificators were specially designed to get blood flowing. We took a look at some particularly gory ones.
There's one that's just the metal box with blades sticking out.
Yeah, it's basically spring-loaded. It's a bit like a flintlock pistol. You'd sort of pull back a hammer, press it against the skin and press a trigger, and blades or steel blades would come shooting out into the skin.
Oh, that sounds horrible.
The other one, as you can see, is rather like a razor crossed with a lawnmower. And you'd sort of, again, run it along the skin and it would open up the skin and allow you to bleed.
It all sounds quite horrible to me. What diseases would they prescribe bloodletting for?
Pretty much anything. You would prescribe it for diseases where there was an excess of blood. And if you have too much blood, you get overheated, feverish, you get overexcited. So letting out blood was a way to sort of calm somebody down. And of course, if you lose 3 or 4 pints of blood, physiologically you get calmer to the point of unconsciousness.
How did we come away from this idea of blood coming from the liver and begin understanding blood?
It's not until the end of the 18th century that ideas about therapeutic bloodletting really start to change, and that's with the revolution in medicine called Paris medicine. Doctors start thinking more surgical. They start thinking about the fine level structure and the detailed anatomy of the human body, and they start also to collect data on patients. And one of the things that becomes very clear from this data is that therapeutic bloodletting has no effect whatsoever. And this is where you start to get the idea of transfusion.
If you needed blood, they'd stick a needle in my arm with a tube and stick the needle in your arm and hope it flowed the right way?
Well, exactly. You had, as with plumbing, you always had to be careful to connect the pipes the right way round. But yes, absolutely, a very simple and a very effective fare, especially on battlefields.
But they didn't start directly with human-to-human transfusions, did they?
Well, there was a long history of experimental transfusion, looking back to the old classical idea of your humours determining your character. So the idea was if you took blood out of a kind of angry, vicious dog and put it into a sheep and vice versa, you might get an angry, vicious sheep and a rather calmer, sheep-like dog.
And did they apply that to people as well?
There were some experiments with transfusing blood into criminals to try and sort of calm criminals. But the problem that all of these early transfusions faced was that very, very rarely they'd work. And there was really no sense of why this was happening until the work of Karl Landsteiner, who elucidates the blood groups.
So he was the one who discovered blood types?
Yes, his work is part of a movement to try and understand the immune system and then the other functions of blood as well.
Once blood groups were discovered, it was recommended that people were tested before transfusion, which still happens today. But to start with, there was a problem of actually storing blood.
And this becomes a real problem a few years after Landsteiner's work with the outbreak of the First World War. Suddenly, blood loss becomes a problem affecting all of the large European armies. And it's discovered during the First World War, I think quite by chance, that mixing some sodium citrate into the blood stops it from clotting. So you can start to store blood, you can start to build up blood banks. in 1939, at the outbreak of the Second World War here in Britain, you get blood banks set up in London, and the blood transfusion service proves its worth during the Blitz.
So that was the real start of donation, and people at home would go along and give their blood.
Yes, this is where scientific development starts to mesh with cultural ideas as well. Here in Britain, ever since the 30s and the 40s, we've had this idea that blood transfusion is a kind of civic duty. It's something you can do for society with the idea that if and when you need it, somebody else will be there to do it for you.
Richard Barnett at the Wellcome Collection in London, speaking there with Heather Douglas.